3. In case you're wondering, and I'm guessing you are, I know some of you will be, the answer is $40 a day for the first 6 days, and then $80 a day after that. Then it's up to a juror's employer. They're supposed to make up the difference between what the juror receives from the state and their normal salary. $400 a week was the figure the state felt was fair to pay a person to be the ultimate adjudicator of fact in a triple murder trial that could lead to the accused being deprived of liberty for 30 years or so. It's not really about money, though. I could see that. If I were on trial, I wouldn't want to think the jurors were only there for the money. I'd want them to take pride in the role they'd been chosen for and to reach their decision based on their careful assessment of all the facts, which was exactly what I was going to do for Aaron. If you want to make money from the law, you'd better do well at high school and become a lawyer. All that said, it was a little disappointing they couldn't put something into catering. At around 1:50 p.m. on that first day, after a stern warning about not discussing the case with anyone and not getting drawn into conversation with anyone, we were released for lunch, which meant going outside and lining up for a sandwich at the same cafes as the police, the Patterson family, and half the world's media. And, in my case, finding a cafe with some halfway tempting gluten-free and dairy-free options. Going forward, it was going to be easier to pack my own lunch. I cottoned onto that pretty quickly. At 3 p.m, we were back for a final address from Justice Beale. Most of it was process. What we had to do to select a foreperson, followed by more warnings about COVID, before the role of the jury was then explained in detail, which I had heard before. In essence, we were the only ones who could make a decision about the facts. It was not the judge's responsibility to decide the case. His role was to ensure the trial was fair and conducted in accordance with the law. We had to follow any directions he gave us about the law, but we were not bound by any comments he might make about the facts. He also told us what is and is not evidence. In a nutshell, evidence is the testimony of witnesses, plus items or documents that are submitted as exhibits, plus agreed facts. They were the only three things that could be considered evidence, and we had to decide the case only on the basis of that evidence. You must ignore all other considerations. In particular, you should dismiss any feelings of sympathy for or prejudice against the accused or anyone else. No such emotion has any part to play in your decision. You must dispassionately weigh the evidence logically and with an open mind, not according to your passions or feelings. Your duty is to consider the evidence using your head, not your heart. I absolutely get it, Your Honour. But voiding ourselves of all emotion? I'm just not sure that's possible. I can't just switch off all my emotions, like swiveling a tap mixer to cold. I'm not sure anyone can do that, unless you're a psychopath. Also, there might be times when it is difficult to assess the evidence and decide what is likely to be true without imagining yourself in the same emotional position. After all, isn't that how social creatures form relationships with the rest of their tribe? Our behaviours are shaped by logic and emotion. Otherwise, we'd all be Vulcans. When you retire to consider your verdict, Beale continued, you must not base your decision on any information you obtain outside this courtroom. Don't risk your opinion as judges of the facts being contaminated. You must consider and base your decision only on the evidence presented to you here in court. Tick. Understood. Now, I note that most of you, he intoned gravely, pivoting to a different topic, will probably be aware from previous media coverage that the accused was charged by police with 3 counts of attempted murder in relation to her estranged husband, Simon Patterson. Yes, we had. I certainly had. What was the story there? Those charges have been discontinued by the Director of Public Prosecutions. In other words, those charges have been dropped and you must put them out of your mind. Well, you can say that, but I can't just order myself to forget something. There had to be reasons why those charges were brought in the first place, and reasons why they were dropped. Couldn't we get a little more info? The most obvious conclusion was that, on closer examination, the evidence required to secure a conviction on those charges did not stack up. In other words, it was a witch hunt. They'd been gunning for Aaron on anything they could find, but when it came to the crunch, they'd had to admit they didn't have enough ammo. However, there were other possibilities. Maybe it was money. Adding an extra 3 charges to her indictment could have meant an extra month of evidence and another couple of $1 million out of the DPP's budget. If the beef Wellington lunch was the strongest case, they may have decided just to focus on that. Funnily enough, when you try to put something out of your mind, it just draws attention to it and you end up thinking about it more. At least that's how my mind works. But Justice Beale moved on quickly from Aaron's other attempted murder charges and never mentioned them again. Most importantly, you must not make any investigations or inquiries or conduct independent research concerning any aspect of the case or any person connected with it. That includes research about the law that applies to the case. You must not search for information about the case on Google or any other sites like Google, or look at such sites for more information about the case. The less we knew, the better. That's what it sounded like. But this time, Beale did go on to explain the reasoning. Some claims made by or repeated in the media might sound true, but in fact be false. It would be unfair to the accused if we were making decisions using information the court and the parties didn't know we had, particularly if it was wrong. That made sense. You would cease being a juror, that is, a judge of the facts, and would have instead taken on the role of an investigator. Yeah. But again, like the head and the heart distinction, these roles were presented as though they were at different ends of the park and could never interact. In the eyes of Justice Beale, a juror was either a judge of the facts or an investigator. And yet in normal day-to-day human life, don't they go hand in hand? That's how I get through life. Well, that and coffee. To find out whether something's bullshit or not, I usually go on asking questions and looking for as much information as I can find. Anyway, the counter-argument, I suppose, is that a murder trial is not representative of day-to-day human life. And in order to make it as fair as possible, the two roles need to be separated, which would be fine if the jury was presented with all the information available and or could ask questions to seek more information themselves with the full knowledge of the court. But I knew from my earlier stint on a jury that many facts are ruled inadmissible in pre-trial hearings for a variety of reasons, and other facts are ruled irrelevant and forbidden from being led. Sometimes exchanges in a transcript or information in a document are redacted and the jury sees the redaction but cannot ask to see what was redacted. And sometimes a document is altered so the jury is unaware there's even been a redaction, which is just plain deception. Deceiving the jury, in some instances, is judicially considered the only course available to maintaining integrity and a fair trial for the accused. Jurors, therefore, including yours truly, were in essence only ever presented with carefully curated packets of information that had been deemed appropriate. The theory is that uncurated information might unfairly influence our decision-making. Well, Your Honour, I can only ask, would it unfairly influence you if this was a judge-alone trial? It was hard not to feel managed. And, on top of that, it was hard not to feel like we were being managed because there was a chance we were either uneducated or too emotional and credulous to be trusted with everything. Okay, fine. He was telling me the rules. I was listening.
Grr.
To be clear, though, I can whinge and complain in private, but I didn't want the whole trial discontinued, God forbid. So the only evidence I'll be discussing here is the evidence legally presented to us, the jury, in court. We didn't find out about all the other stuff until later. Justice Beale was at pains to conclude that if we didn't abide by the rules, it would undermine public confidence in the jury system, and the jury system has been a fundamental feature of our criminal justice system for centuries. But most things can still gain from refinement, can't they? They can be refitted for purpose in a different age. Do they ever give jurors feedback forms seeking suggestions on how things could be improved? Just a thought. Some of the rules, to be fair, were good ones. Justice Beale advised that it was up to us how much we decided to believe when we were listening to witnesses, and we had to distinguish between their credibility, honesty, and their reliability. Even the honest ones can be completely wrong. This is something you all do all the time in your daily lives. There is no special skill involved. You just need to use your common sense, he said. Good. I've got loads of that. At least I think I do. We also had to keep an open mind about the accuracy of the witness testimonies until all the evidence had been presented. The open mind thing was becoming a theme, just in case we hadn't been listening the first time. Then came the burden and standard of proof. A critical part of our justice system is that people are presumed innocent unless and until they are proved guilty. Yep, heard that before. Miss Patterson does not have to prove anything, said Justice Beale. It is not for her to demonstrate her innocence, but for the prosecution to prove the charges they have brought against her. You may only convict the accused of an offence if you are satisfied that her guilt is the only reasonable conclusion to be drawn from the whole of the evidence, both direct and indirect. If there is another reasonable view of the facts which is consistent with the accused's innocence on a charge, then the prosecution will not have proved her guilt beyond reasonable doubt, and you must acquit her of that charge. I liked that last bit. Inside a blizzard of legal speak, which had made it difficult to see the path we had to follow, that stuck with me. That was the yardstick I was going to return to many times in the days and weeks ahead. We were ready to hear the opening addresses. At long last, Justice Beale sat back in his bench and allowed others to command centre stage. Dr. Nanette Rogers, SC, led the prosecution, and Mr. Colin Mandy, SC, led Erin's defence. I'd seen more similarities between chalk and cheese. Nanette had clearly decided that hair straighteners were a vastly overrated invention and saw no point investing her time or money in such flippant grooming accessories. And compared to others in the legal profession, she had developed a sartorial style that suggested a more bohemian background than the standard conservative barrister. Flying the flag for the standard conservative barrister was the sharp, impish, and rather handsome figure of Colin Mandy. Well-groomed and manicured, with a racy number 3 or 4 haircut, he wore his traditional barrister's suit, cape, and silly white collar with a grace and ease that suggested he had that rare knack among men of dressing with a pinch of flamboyance, but nothing ever quite in excess. He projected excellent taste and, most impressively, a wonderfully precise sense of humour. Murder trials are obviously not theatres of comedy, and given that the future of Erin's life was in the balance, there were not many opportunities for amusing wit. Nonetheless, 3 or 4 did occur. And while Colin Mandy never strayed from propriety, I'll just be honest and say the moments he chose to frame with humour were exquisite. Which was attractive. No more than that, but yes, all right, I found that attractive. But could he sway me? No. Not consciously. I was taking this seriously. Nonetheless, the tensions and tricks that would gently tug our minds away from being open were in play before we even realized what they were. In hindsight, they were there from the first ball toss.